All right. Hello and welcome, everybody, to the new Dead Draw Gaming podcast. I am so excited to be here with you all today. My name is Etchy. Just a brief introduction on myself, since I am new to the team and new to this podcast and everything. I'm mostly known for being a Pokemon speedrunner, but I've been playing TCG for almost 2 years now. I have put on some live event stuff in the past. I play a lot. I am not the greatest player in the world by any means, but fortunately, my experience gap and skill gap is being covered by three of the amazing Team Dead Draw Gaming members here with us today. So I'm just going to throw it to them for the intros. So first of all, we have Jake Gearhart, everyone's favorite Iron Hands enjoyer. Jake, how are we doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm very excited for this. There's so much cool things we can do with this podcast. I'm really excited to see where we go with it, where we take it. Just kind of generally explaining really quickly before we keep going with the intros. The general idea for this podcast is going to be going through a lot of different topics, both related to current TCG events and also specific topics and themes in the future. This one we're going to be focusing on rotation, probably primarily, and a little bit of Paldean Fates, but it's kind of fluid and we're going to kind of see how things go from there. But our next speaker today is Gabriel Smart, who just came off a top 8 Dortmund run. Gabe, how are we doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Been traveling quite a bit. Feels nice to have a couple of weeks off before Vancouver regionals. So it's been, you know, kind of nice trying to catch up on things, trying to get ready for post-rotation as well. So, you know, even though there aren't any tournaments coming up for the next week or two, there's a lot of stuff, you know, coming up in the future. So, you know, just trying to get ready for that.
Yeah, definitely a lot to look forward to, which we'll talk about a lot during this podcast episode. And our final guest, the back-to-back Lugia regional champion, Andrew Hedrick. How we doing?
Doing okay. I'm also glad for the break without regionals for a while, because I've had midterms over the last few weeks. So been trying to get those done, but excited to be back on the podcast and talk with the boys.
I am excited as well. So there's a lot of stuff to talk about today. Like I said, we're going to talk about Paldean Fate format. Like you said, there's not a lot of events coming up for us as Americans, but there are still events going on. There's Utrecht this weekend, and then there's also the Brazilian regional, which is going to be next weekend. We'll talk a little bit about the Paldean Fates format as a whole. Should cover us for both those regionals. But before we get into that, Pokemon Day was yesterday. We're recording this on Wednesday. And we've all been exposed to the new future for the Pokemon trading card game, which is Pokemon Trading Card Game Pocket. Are you guys excited to become pros and get your Worlds Invite in Pocket? Yeah, that was really enthusiastic.
Seems really interesting. I don't know. It's like, it seems pretty different from the actual regular trading card game, right? I mean, they still have like cards, but it's kind of, it seems like it plays a lot different.
Yeah, did you all see like all the kind of changes they've made for this?
What I think it might be is kind of like a I think it's similar to, I don't know if it's like exactly like some other card games, but I think they might be trying to have like a gateway into the TCG. Mm-hmm. Where like it's like a very basic, you know, like I don't think that any competitive TCG players will have a hard time understanding what's going on. And also we have like so little, I mean, like information as well on it. You like the stuff that they could have provided us could have just been just like beta testing stuff. Like we don't really have any idea, because we've like seen with live that, you know, they showed us a very unfinished product the last time we got a TCG card game. But it might be kind of like an easier Pokemon almost, and kind of like a gateway into it. I honestly do not know. It was a very interesting trailer.
So I actually have a lot of thoughts on this, and I waited, like I could have posted something about it yesterday, but I wanted to like let it all sink in to get my thoughts. But surprisingly, I'm actually like a huge fan of this, them coming out with this. I think this like sort of solidifies, maybe there's some like huge a master plan going on with this product, but over the past couple of years. So what this product is, I think it's like, first and foremost, it's like a collection app. Like you open your packs and you trade with other people.
Yep.
And it's got special artwork, so you get all the collectors to play this. And it just so happens to have this battle thing that you can do if you want. You don't have to worry about it. But the battle system seems to be designed so that it's very, very difficult to make a bad deck. So like the difference between a good deck with this and a bad deck is going to be pretty small. And if you just put the shiny cards in your deck, they're probably good because they're EXs and they'll be a bit more powerful than everything else. So I looked at like all the new cards that are designed, and it seems like they're first of all, the mechanics that they've simplified, it's basically the same game. It's like, yeah, it's the same Pokemon game that we've all been playing, but taken a couple things are removed from it to make deck building easier, or like make the game simpler in that. So one of the issues with like the Pokemon card game in terms of making a good deck is you have to play a lot of consistency cards. And if your deck doesn't have consistency cards, you're not going to have a good time. So the fact that you don't need to find your energy cards in your deck means that you don't need consistency cards, because you can just, you've got your energies right away. If you just have a handful of Pokemon, you're fine. You're attacking, so you can at least start playing a game.
Yeah.
Whereas if you had to have like draw cards, you'd have to find you draw cards to find your energy cards to attach to your Pokemon. And then there's also the removal of the prize card mechanic, which I think is more of the fact that they want the game to be faster. And just like they're using a point system, like it says on the EX rule box that EXs give up 2 points.
Yeah.
So it's called a point system.
Yeah, and it looks like you need either 3 or 4 points to win the game. There's like a graphic on the bottom of the screen that fills up when you have, it's like 1, 2, and 3. So I'm assuming it's either 4 or 3. 4 probably makes more sense with EXs. So
I think it is going to be 3, at least from the trailer. It looked like 3. But that does actually add like a bit of element of strategy. Like you're like, try and get like the 4-prize game involved. It's now, instead of a 7-prize game, you're playing a 4-prize game. I think this whole thing sort of like is coming at the perfect time, because it seemed like during the Sword and Shield era, and like they mentioned this in an article about the Black and White game design as well. In the Sword and Shield era, they had like very simplified mechanics. It was very easy to pick up like the best deck and just play it, and you were probably going to be fine. Like, you pick up Eternatus and you bench all your dark Pokemon, and then you hit for 270 and you're probably winning the game as long as you flip heads on Crushing Hammers. So anyone who is like slightly interested in the TCG, and it also helped that we had the pandemic, ironically, that people had more free time to look into games like Pokemon. So everyone who was like mildly interested in strategy games would have tried Pokemon over the pandemic and got into it on some level. And anyone who's not interested in it, you're going to have to use a different avenue to get them interested. And so now with Scarlet and Violet coming around, we see like the game getting significantly more complicated and like geared towards competitive players by the fact that they're like reprinting ideas from the Ruby and Sapphire era. So they're like reprinting Pidgeot and like Countercatcher, all these different ideas from when the competitive players liked the game most. So almost like an apology for what they did, but really to say that like this game is the competitive game, because now they have a different game. They have a simplified version with a simplified metagame, which is meant to get new people involved. So anyone who plays this new game might play like one battle or like one battle every couple days or something. And they'll open their daily packs and they'll enjoy it. And then maybe one day they'll see like they'll open a physical pack of the cards and realize, oh, hey, there's this physical card game. I could play this as well. And then they learn that the mechanics are more complicated, but they've already been introduced to the game through this like new digital fast play format. So I think it's a really great game, really great thing for the game that we have this extra entry point. And it's not like it's a different game. It's they've only changed the mechanics enough to where deck building becomes like easier. They've left everything else alone. The only other thing that like I noticed they changed was on like the Greninja card. Like it says, once during your turn, you may do 2 damage, or you may do 20 damage to one of your opponent's Pokemon, instead of put 2 damage counters like we would have. But that makes sense to simplify. Like they don't need a distinction between damage counters and damage in this game.
Yeah, I think the comparison a lot of people are making are to like Yu-Gi-Oh with Duel Links. For those who don't know about Duel Links, it's essentially a game that they launched like 8 years ago or something. It's like a mobile focused Yu-Gi-Oh game where that's basically a much more streamlined format of Yu-Gi-Oh, where it's 4,000 life points instead of 8,000, and then the game's mechanics were stripped back like 20 years basically to like the early days. And then
what game was this called again? It was the Duel Links.
Duel Links.
Yeah, I tried that.
Yeah.
Because like I knew like the old rules, and that brought me back into Yu-Gi-Oh
right.
for like a couple days. Because I got it, I was like, okay, this makes sense. So
it did the same thing to me in like 2018. Yeah. I think this kind of does a lot of that same thing, and I think this also like Jake was saying, it doesn't really I don't think it removes stuff to the degree that Duel Links does. I think the game is very, like you said, just the same thing simplified. And not like we saw the EX mechanics, so like the mechanics should be generally the same. It's just there's less to worry about and less ways to mess up, which I think is really cool.
And I also think it's super cool that they're like rebalancing everything. Like we saw the EXs have the power level they should have had 10 years ago with Black and White. They're sort of like acknowledging their mistake with like the Mewtwo EX back then at 170 HP. This one's got 150. But the basics are like the non-EXs are still more powerful than they were back then. So I think it's like a cool thing that we also get to see like what the game would be if they got to reset it.
For sure.
I think Gabe brought up a good point too about how like, you know, he had played Yu-Gi-Oh a long time ago, hadn't played for a while, and then it kind of got him back into it. Like that same thing had happened with people who played Pokemon a long time ago when the rules were simpler, maybe when they were a kid. And then if they played the game now, if it wasn't quite as complicated, it would be easier to get them back into it.
For sure. And even as Jake was saying, like tempting in those collectors with free virtual packs, and then they're like, oh yeah, I'll play a game if I get like an extra pack from it or something. And then they learn the game, and that helps them watch the actual live tournaments, because the game is not that different from if they're watching the live tournaments, and the casters can bridge the gaps between the pocket game and the live game. So yeah, I think it's really interesting. And I think what you were saying too, Jake, was something I hadn't really thought about. Just kind of the game slowly getting more complicated since Scarlet Violet came out compared to recent years. Because we just recorded a Gardevoir versus Gardevoir mirror match, which will go up on the DG channel between Jake and Gabe before this podcast recording. And that was really complicated. Like, I can't imagine being a beginner player just picking up the Gardevoir starter deck that comes out in a couple weeks and trying to do that kind of mirror match and thinking through all those things. Like it's a lot to take in for your average beginner player, and this can be a great way to streamline that. So pretty cool. Any other thoughts on TCG Pocket before we go on? Are we all going for a world invite in it?
I think the only other thing to mention is that like there was a lot of like negative reaction online about like comparing it to live, and I think live is probably just in an unfortunate spot that like we happen to have a pandemic which pushed like all the competitive players to ask for a new client when TBCI probably already knew that this thing was going to come out, so maybe they felt like pressured to create something new. But I think live is in a not great state, but if we're going to have like an entry point into the card game that we can point people to, it's better that we can point them to this thing.
Yeah, which will, that's true.
The rules will be simple and they can use whatever card they want, which is like the best thing about it is that like you pull your shiny new EX card and it's good. Or you pull your Snorlax, which has 150 HP and does 70 damage, and you like the artwork and you want to put in your deck, it's still good. It's good enough. Where like the difference between a terrible deck and a playable deck is like that doesn't exist. Whereas in live, like you got to learn you get your free starter deck, but you're like thrown right in. You have to play the Arcanine EX deck with Bibarel and learn how to play like the full game. You can't use what you want to use because the cards you like the artwork of suck.
Yeah, definitely a interesting point with it. And it seems like it's a great way to just bring in those types of players. And it, just being the game I can point new players to. Like when I was doing a beginner focused event, I did a live event where I taught a bunch of players how to play the Pokemon TCG for the first time last summer, and I was like hesitant to recommend people to go download live after because I was like scared that they would try it and hate it, whereas now if Pocket's a thing, I can just tell them, oh, go play Pocket, yeah, it'll give you the intro and it'll be perfect. Another thing that happened with Pokemon Day yesterday was the announcement of a Gen 6 Legends game, and this, Jake wanted me specifically to bring this up because They teased Mega Evolutions, and that means there might possibly be a return to Mega Evolutions for the TCG. Why did you want me to bring this up, Jake?
I mentioned this on Twitter as well, but I think just the this is like the first time that we've seen a mechanic video game mechanic return, like a video game gimmick, because they only started doing those with Gen 6, like mm-hmm. the Mega Z moves, Dynamax, Terastal, whatever. So this is the first time we're getting a gimmick back. And I think the gimmicks, like transferring them from the video game to the card game, is like the most interesting thing. And usually we only get that like every 3 years, like we get the new whatever. But this time we get it a little bit earlier. So I think there's a lot of different possibilities they can go with this. Like one of them is just combining like two of the things from XY, which were break Pokemon and Megas. They could just use the break mechanic, but call them Megas again. Like personally, one of my hopes is that they actually keep the old Mega Evolution rule of like your turn ends when you evolve it, but they actually balance it properly this time so that the cards are good enough that you don't need Spirit Links for them. Because I think it would be really cool if you had to evolve and wait and just end your turn by evolving, but the card was good enough that was a trade-off that you could weigh the benefits and costs of.
Gotcha.
It'd have to be pretty insane for that to be worth it, I feel like. Because that would make it really hard to evolve to like a second one later in the game, too. Like at the beginning of the game, you could definitely afford to do that, but they would have to be pretty good, I think.
Yeah, I feel like if they do like one prizers that have like the stats of EXs, that could work. Like you have a Charizard with 330 HP that's a one prizer. And then you'd also need like probably some like way to protect from boss's orders or something like that. But they could print another like effect on it that says you can't be gusted, or like print another Pokemon that says if you have a Mega in play it can't be bossed. I don't know, but there's a lot of things.
Megas are definitely going to be multi-prizers.
Yeah, breaks were one prizers, so I feel like they could do that again. Yeah,
cool. Yeah, I would be excited to see that. But again, maybe more reason for them to make the simpler format, as we're just getting more and more complicated, adding more gimmicks and whatnot to our format. So the next thing I want to talk about was a little bit of Paldean Fates format stuff. We're not going to go too in-depth with it. Like I said, Vancouver is still almost a month away, so we'll do another podcast closer to Vancouver where we'll really kind of dive into the format. But the main thing I wanted to start with here was Gabe's top 8 Dortmund run. Gabe, how did that go? What happened?
A lot of things went well. So I've been playing a little bit more Gardevoir recently. Been learning the deck a lot. People like Andrew and a couple other members of Team DDG, like Michael Davidson, have been helping me out. So I'm in Discord at 1 a.m. in the morning playing games with, you know, Gardevoir and Ladders. So I've been, you know, quietly playing the deck a lot more. For a lot of tournaments, I was just playing things like Mew, and then I was, you know, like really like working on Gardevoir because I didn't want to show up to an event with it, like unless I knew pretty much exactly what I was doing. So I started to show up to a couple regionals with it. I've day 2'd everyone I've played in with the deck. And yeah, I got top 8s. Things went pretty well. The deck list was, you know, pretty solid. I guess the one big thing that was different from my deck list as opposed to a lot of others was I did play 3 VIP pass and 3 Fog Crystal, as opposed to, you could say, the more standard 4 VIP pass and 2 Fog Crystal. And it ended up working out, you know, really, really nicely. Yeah, I ended up losing to Goldango. Didn't draw great in top cut. I went first in game 1 in top 8 and then missed turn 2 Mirage Step or a second Ralts. So I instantly lost one game 2, and then game 3 just did not go my way. But, you know, I'm still happy with the top 8, you know, over 1,300 players there. So, you know, definitely was not easy, but yeah.
And one thing that kind of stood out from that event was immediately 3 Gardevoirs in top 8, all also not from Europe, you being one of them. It just seems like Gardevoir is in a really strong place in the meta right now. I feel like every time I look on Twitter, I just see people like, oh, I won my League Cup with Gardevoir, won a League Cup, won a League Challenge, blah, 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 with Gardevoir. And then it just kind of seems like it's broken. And I wanted to ask you, Gabe, specifically, because you mentioned in a tweet, you said Gardevoir just beats the whole format right now. You are literally throwing, not playing it. Can you elaborate on those thoughts?
Yeah, so I don't know what time I posted this. Okay. it must have been pretty late at night. Okay, so like the more like premise of the tweet is, yeah, I think that Gardevoir's worst matchups are notoriously pretty inconsistent decks that don't necessarily set up all the time. Things like Chen Pao can be a little bit of a scary matchup. That deck obviously has major consistency issues. Thing like Maridon as well just sometimes don't function, which is also one of Gardevoir's quote unquote, you know, like hardest matchups. But I think the biggest thing is with the rise of Roaring Moon. A couple of months ago, you know, back when Roaring Moon first came out at the Latin American International Championships, I believe that was the first event with Roaring Moon legal, right? You know, looking at that, the meta was, you know, completely different. People didn't necessarily know how to build the Roaring Moon deck, so Roaring Moon pretty much just flopped. You know, people thought it was just going to be like another, you know, deck that everyone hyped up, then just did absolutely terrible. And as time, you know, kind of went on, we saw Ross's top eight build from Charlotte, and the deck, you know, kind of started to like slowly go up, like maybe one turn it was 3%, and then maybe went 4%, then it went 6%, and it just like continued to grow and grow and grow, which is actually one of Gardevoir's, you know, strongest matchups. So Gardevoir pretty much got an extra 10-12% of the format swinging heavily like into Gardevoir's favor. I think the matchup is at least 60-40 in Gardevoir's favor. So Gardevoir got 10-15% stronger right off the bat. And also with, you know, decks like Chen Pao and also Maridon, you know, starting to lose a lot of popularity as well. Now, obviously, Chen Pao is, you know, back on the rise, but, you know, for quite some time, like Chen Pao was not really considered a top 5 or even 10 deck even. You know, pretty much most of Gardevoir's hardest matchups were kind of going out of the format. And, you know, like other decks like Roaring Moon, we're starting to see a lot more play, which is one of Gardevoir's strongest matchups. So, like, I think that's why, you know, Gardevoir has been seeing a lot more success and why, you know, we finally have been seeing it, like, winning tournaments. Because for quite some time, Gardevoir would make it in the top eight, but it would never really get past top eight, top four, or second. I know Tord got second with it twice at Worlds and also EYC, but it never could necessarily get, you know, over the hump. And now, you know, we saw Brisbane with Harry winning, and then at Knoxville with Ryan Antonucci winning, the deck is finally, you know, showing that it's always had that capability, which I think we always knew it did. But I think the meta is just finally perfect for it.
Yeah.
Where the deck is just absolutely just like dominating tournaments now.
Any thoughts you want to add on to that, Jake, as the resident person who has played Gardevoir to every event this season?
I mean, yeah, I think I agree with Gabe a lot that the Roaring Moon has like made it much better to play Gardevoir, because yeah. Roaring Moon is like a good Maridon matchup. I guess it's like pretty close to 50-50, but Roaring Moon like kind of gives some of the other decks that struggle, that Gardevoir struggles against, yeah, trouble themselves.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
It's also a favorable matchup.
Yeah, like Maridon numbers have definitely gone down. A lot of Maridon players just end up switching to Moon because it does a lot of the same things, but more consistently. Moon is completely decimated Rapid, which can be a bad matchup for Guardi, depending on like, yeah, what techs you include.
I forgot to mention that. Thank you.
Yeah, like Rapid disappearing almost immediately as soon as Moon really took over is probably another huge factor. So, yeah, I mean, makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
But yeah, I also think that like the reason why Gardevoir just isn't even more play than it is right now. It's already going up, but it's just because the deck is like so hard to play. Like I know for, like I was playing the deck for, since basically after EUIC last year, and I've played it to basically every tournament since. Like I played at Lost Box for a little bit, but I know that like I was not playing too well back then. And it's taken me like at least like until like the first half of this season to get to the point where like I'm confident I could like get into like the top 32s, top 16s if I get a good run. But yeah, before then, I like the small decisions add up after a while, so it's a very hard deck to do well with,
for sure. The other deck I wanted to mention, the last kind of deck I want to talk about for the Paldean Fates format, is Giratina. Andrea played Giratina to Knoxville, I believe, to a top 64 finish. Yeah. It's a deck that we saw is just had an unmatched stretch for parts of the season where it just won like two or three regionals. I don't remember exactly, but at least two, and just looked like the BDIF in a lot of situations during that time. So do you still think its position is as dominant as it seemed like it was last month, Andrew?
I don't really feel like it's gotten into a worse position. Obviously the rise of Guardi isn't a great matchup, but it's also not like a bad matchup for Tina either. Usually all the games end up feeling really close, mm-hmm, in that matchup. So I don't think that's a huge issue. The Rise of Moon is definitely not great for Giratina. That matchup can be pretty scary. Although it's not a terrible matchup by any means. And also, if you want to play something like Spirit Tomb to turn off their Moltres and slow them down, that's also an option as well. So overall, I mean, Tina's just like always like the thing about the deck is it just can make all of its matchups close, take close matchups to anything. So meta changing around it really doesn't matter that much as long as like, you know, the deck itself still works. So I don't know. I think it's still going to be in a fine spot. I think it will still get played at Vancouver. It will be pretty popular and it will still do well the rest of the format till rotation.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense for sure. So, like I said, Utrecht this weekend. Last minute predictions, Gabe. What do you think is going to win?
So the last regional we've actually had is Dortmund. So looking at it, I think that I'm going to go out on a limb. It's hard not to pick Mew and EU, you know, it's kind of me, but I am going to say I'm going to pick Roaring Moon. Just you know, going to make a hot take. I'm going to think I think that Roaring Moon might get its first win.
I was going to say, like, do you think people are going to react appropriately or overreact to this sudden kind of surge in Gardevoir, or do you think that'll still be fine enough for Moon to kind of get through there?
I don't think so. I think that I actually changed my answer. I'll say I think that Moon or Charizard are decent. I think that Charizard's also actually really good right now.
Yeah, Charizard, the deck that everyone's like not talking about, and a lot of people have kind of fallen off on, but it's still Charizard. It's still a pretty good.
Charizard
deck
is good because you can play Double Lost City to try and fix the Chen Pao and Gardevoir matchup, but helps that significantly. So I actually will change my answer. I think actually like Charizard's in a really good like position.
I'm sorry
right
for helping you change your answer, but
yeah, it's okay. But no, I mean, like, I don't think Gardevoir is going to rise that much. So if Gardevoir was 10% at Dortmund, I don't think it's going to hit 15% at, let's say, like Utrecht or, like the Brazilian like tournament or even like Vancouver. I think that it would have to win, Utrecht and also, the Brazilian tournament to hit that 15-ish% heading into Vancouver. And that's just largely because a lot of people don't feel comfortable playing Gardevoir. So like one of the reasons to why like I haven't been like playing the deck for the past, you know, like 20 tournaments is because it took me some time to understand all the lines and stuff.
Yeah,
like, you know, like I like specifically was like, okay, I don't know if I want to play Gardevoir to NAIC. That was a deck I was kind of considering, and then like Worlds as well, and like I was kind of thinking about playing Gardevoir, but I decided just like not to, and you know, kind of went with my comfort pick. And decks like Roaring Moon, decks like Maridon, for example, decks like Lost on Giratina even now are a lot of people's comfort picks. So I don't think the percentage of Gardevoir will go up more than like maybe 2 or 3% like max.
Gotcha. Andrew, what are your predictions for Utrecht?
I don't know. I think that probably the two decks that do the best will have to be Gardevoir and Giratina. Obviously, those are the decks that the best players seem to like. And obviously, Gardevoir has been doing better recently, and I don't expect Giratina to fall off. I think the two best performing decks will probably have to be Gardevoir and Giratina, and I expect one of them to get the win.
Okay. Straightforward. I like it. Jake?
I mean, I'll just go with the Gardevoir. I think it's the best deck, and I think if Tord and Demi and all the other like good Gardevoir players in Europe are at the tournament, they'll have a good shot at winning.
Gotcha. Cool. All right. Like I said, we'll go more in depth on the Paldean Fates format in a future podcast. I really want to spend a lot of time talking about rotation and EUIC, which, again, those are also over a month away. But this is the time where people are really starting to start testing and mess around with things, especially because Champions League just happened in Japan. We saw Lugia take the win there. So we have the resident Lugia expert here, Andrew. So I figured that probably is a good place to start. Obviously, this Lugia deck looks very different from what we saw, you know, when you got your wins with it almost not 2 years ago, almost a year and a half ago, something like that.
About a year ago.
Okay. Time is wild. Anyway, so have you messed around with the Lugia too much post rotation, and what are your thoughts on it, Andrew?
Yeah, I've been thinking about it a lot. I think the really only card that you lose that's like important to the deck working is Professor Burnett.
Yeah.
Which is obviously a pretty important card for the deck and one that really made it function, especially after we lost like all of our other discarding cards to the last rotation. Burnett was like the one way you could consistently get your Archeops in the discard pile. And we don't have that now, right? Which is kind of an issue. But as a trade-off, we do get a really good attacking option in Cincino. that lets you one-shot things. And also the format will definitely slow down a little bit with rotation, with decks losing some of their consistency, like Battle VIP Pass, which means that you, if you don't get the turn two summoning star off, the fact that the format's slower and you have that one-shot potential with a one-prizer means that, you know, you can maybe afford to read the win turn two, you know, play a little bit slower, and then gets it up turn three. So I think that even without Professor Burnett, even if you're not always getting that turn two double Archeops, the deck will still definitely be able to work and be able to see success. But yeah, I think it'll be pretty good.
I feel like the deck almost plays more like Gardevoir does now than even Lugia in the past or anything, where you spend like a couple turns just setting your board up with, like, you got Mirage Step before Read Wind now, or Call for Family on the Mincino. And then you just take a chain of two prize knockouts with a one prizer, and just Gift Energy is your draw engine now, instead of like abilities. So I think and the fact that you also have Snorlax to be difficult for like some of those other, the one prizer decks to deal with. Like, you've got Lugia, which is already tanky, especially with the V-Guard and the Mist Energy. Like, that Lugia V-Star itself is a pretty solid attacker now. And then you've got Snorlax for the one prizer matchups, and then Chinchino to uptrade into the two prizers. It's like a very well-rounded deck with only those three attackers.
One interesting thing also is you can potentially attack with Snorlax turn two without using Summoning Star as well, especially if you're playing like the heavy DTE version that did well in Japan. One issue with the deck that I could see, if you're trying to play like Gardevoir, like you're playing slower, is that Cincino is extremely energy intensive, and it could be hard to have enough energy to take three big knockouts with Cincino. But if you take like an early knockout with Snorlax or something, then one shot a couple of two prizers, then maybe, you know, boss kill a one prizer at the end or at some point in the game, that could be maybe an easier way to put off your prizes out. I don't know.
Yeah, I think
I was just going to mention like one addition to this deck could be the Luxray, especially because Lugia, like the mirror, is going to be more popular, and reversal. So you can get an easy early knockout with the Luxray for only one energy, and then have a bunch left over for Chinchino.
Yeah, I don't know how good the list is. Like, I think like the ideas are there, but I was looking at it and like, maybe this is just like, I played Lugia a decent amount, and you know, like, there's like cards that, you know, kind of give me question marks. Be like, okay, why is there no second Luminion? Why is there, you know, no Squawkabilly? And you know, like those things, you know, kind of, you know, like lead back to Jake's thought, is that maybe, you know, like this list is trying to play a little bit more like a Gardevoir deck, where like you really just want to like utilize your one prizes, and you don't necessarily want a bunch of, you know, liabilities, you know, that could be like easily targeted, especially with things like Countercatcher in the format. You know, having a lot of you know, and also like Prime Catcher as well. That's another big thing, is that now that you know, Prime Catcher is a card, things like your Luminions, things like your Squawkabillies, all those things become even more you know, large of a liability, which I think is, you know, really, really important to look at, which I think is, you know, caused, you know, a decent amount of decks to kind of like rethink exactly like what support, you know, Pokemon they actually want. But I guess some of the interesting things are the double Serena in the deck. Only two research was definitely something that kind of makes me think that they were considering playing like this deck at a lot more slower pace, you know, trying to utilize that Read the Wind a little bit more, because typically 3 to 4 Professor's Research is the standard. That's personally what I would have in the list as of right now. But, you know, it's really interesting for sure.
I imagine a lot of kind of weirdness with building the deck now. It's even more important than ever to not discard your energies, which is probably the fear of running like four researches, because Cincino's attack is per energy card. So you just have to be super, super careful with your resources to make sure you map out enough just to actually get the KOs you need to win the game.
Yeah, and I think the Mist Energy is really good as well, that card. Yeah. I wouldn't say it kills Roaring Moon, but it's very, very difficult for Roaring Moon to deal with. Roaring Moon, obviously one of the most popular decks as of right now, actually doesn't lose a whole lot. It does lose the Galarian Moltres, but you do have the option to play the Darkrai V-Star now. But now that, you know, Lugia has something like that Mist Energy, and also in combination with V-Guard Energy as well, it's just an insane combination versus decks like Lasso and Giratina, which also still exist as well. So this deck really, like, the few cards the deck gained are like insanely good. Like, Mist Energy is like just such a powerful card, and also, you know, things like the Master Ball as well is just, you know, very, very strong. And it actually kind of leads me to wonder if this list is built to be more slow. There could even be an argument to play Prime Catcher instead of Master Ball if you're just trying to, you know, like slowly set up. I feel like you could reasonably set up, you know, statistically almost exactly the same without the Master Ball. So that's something that I'm actually going to put some, you know, time into heading into the European International Championships, which is the first, you know, like major, you know, TBCI held event with the, you know, set. Legal to kind of get an idea of exactly how good the Master Ball actually is, because I guess that was, you know, one of the biggest like takeaways from the tournament was, you know, see Master Ball win. So
yeah, I feel like Counter Catcher could also be like all right in here if you're if you're really planning to fall behind. But yeah, if you have like this deck doesn't really need to play many supporters like past the early turns once you're set up. Like your gift energies and all these extra like search cards are going to be chaining your Chinchinos in most of your like two prize matchups, and that's all you need for your like draw for the turn. So you can afford to play like a boss's orders like multiple turns in a row just on the back of the gift energy.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. I think the it's kind of, I've been talking to a lot of top players about their rotation testing, and I think the biggest thing that people are afraid of with Lugia is the that one little deck that got 14th place at the Champions League, which is the Iron Hands. People are calling it Future Box, so it's really just an Iron Hands deck. Jake, how scared are you of this deck?
I mean, I actually kind of like this deck. Because it's well, I mean, I think it's a powerful deck, but I think it's like a much more balanced or much more fair like deck than like Maraidon Iron Hands right now, where they've got like the Iron Hands like and Raichu and they just like overwhelm you like as soon as possible. Whereas this deck like it needs to take a turn to use the Maraidon to set up like the one prize Maraidon to get enough energy in play. So you're not going to be like getting turn one hands ever by this deck. If you are, the opponent's probably misplaying because like unless your start was so bad that like the turn one Iron Hands is all they need to win. Like most decks can respond to a turn one Iron Hands, so like you need to spend a couple turns getting the energy in play. And if you go ahead too quickly in prize cards, the Counter Catchers turn off, which is your primary form of gust with this deck, because you have to be playing those draw cards to find your generators and your damage modifiers in order to keep the game going. So I think there's like a much more outplay potential against this deck than something like Maraidon, where you just have to answer everything they can do to you, otherwise you lose. Whereas this deck, there's opportunities where you can like pass with something active if you've got like a way to get rid of it, like in Charizard, if you have a Collapse Stadium or a Turo, like you can afford to just like swing for 180 one turn if you need to or something. It's much less pressuring than and much less prone to just running over someone, like a more skilled player just getting run over by someone high rolling on their generators. Like that's less likely to happen with this deck.
Yeah. I've actually been kind of messing around just with like the deck and trying to figure out exactly how to improve on the list. Yeah, like I also kind of agree with Jake, is the deck is a little bit more tame. It's not necessarily always going, you know, for the YOLO turn one Iron Hands. I do think it's achievable. I personally made a couple of changes. I don't play Morty. I also don't play the Reboot Bot. And instead of Reboot Bot, I play Prime Catcher as of right now. I don't necessarily know how good the Reboot Bot is. Like, yes, it has like its moments. But I think with, you know, things like Generator and the Baton, you don't necessarily have to play it. And I think something like Prime Catcher, you know, kind of allows you to get a little bit more aggressive in games, you know, because you can run into some situations where, like, I don't know, versus Charizard, for example, like you Iron Hands them and then they respond to you, and then you don't have a way necessarily to get around like that Charizard because you're only playing Counter Catcher. You know, one thing that I personally have in the list is also a one of Raichu V. I think it just kind of makes sense, like because the Baton allows you to move the energies around when your Iron Hands gets knocked out. You also have things like the Electric Generator, so it just, I think, kind of makes sense to play a one of Raichu V. You know, maybe that also opens up potentially playing something like a Four Seal Stone in this deck as well. That's also something that you could potentially play because you already played Town Store. I do like the gift energies. I don't know if I'd play three of them. You might be able to get away with two and then adding a 14th energy. I'm not 100% sure, but those are kind of my like takeaways, you know, like from the deck. I definitely think that Raichu was like a, you know, something.
I think that's pretty cool. Like, and I'm so glad you brought up what you just mentioned, Game, because I was literally just arguing with Jake right before this about Prime Catcher versus Reboot Pod, because I was like, I'm putting in the Prime Catcher because I was literally only testing against Zard. And Jake was like, no, you need Reboot Pod. So do you want to talk about that, Jake?
I think Vacuum is really underplayed right now in the, like, from most lists I've seen, because there's so many decks that use tool cards. And this deck is like very, very reliant on the baton if you're not playing the Reboot Pod. So if you run into like a list with like a Zard list with like two Vacuums, you're kind of screwed without it. Unless you like if you get below average variance on your electric generators, like you really need the Reboot Pod. And I feel like the Raichu adds even more reason to want to play the Reboot Pod, because you can immediately out of nowhere get five energies in play Raichu or something. Whereas you don't need to gust if you're just Raichuing off the Reboot Pod. So that's why I like it. I think it's if you're playing Prime Catcher, you're just like way more reliant on electric generator than you need to be. And if we see more of those Vacuums and even Beach Court, which turns off your baton, which is something that like Lost Box can play, and some other decks. If you run into a Beach Court or a Vacuum, it's hard to get up like hard to set up three Iron Hands in a game without the Reboot Pod.
Yeah. My biggest problem is that the Prime Catcher variant. So like the logic behind the Prime Catcher, obviously, the Counter Catcher, is that you use your Maraidon, they take one prize, you then Counter Catcher take the lead by one prize, then they knock you out, go down to three, it's 3-4, and then they take a knockout, you take a knockout, and that's the entire strategy of the deck, is that you go Prime Catcher, there's so many catcher cards in the format now, Counter Catcher, that's just kind of, I think, the strategy, like, from the deck. But the issue is that if they do not knock out the Maraidon, you cannot do that. If you, as like the Charizard player, for example, like allows them to take a lead intentionally, and then you just go Charizard KO, good luck. Because you don't have something like the Counter Catcher as well. So that's my biggest issue with the deck, is I think it's very prone to someone who just chooses not to go onto odd prize cards, because then you have no way to gust anything.
I
don't think four Counter Catcher can ever be the way to play as your only gust. That seems so bad if your opponent doesn't knock out your Maraidon.
Yeah, I agree.
I think the four Counter Catcher is like was really good for like this specific tournament, because no one was gonna play correctly against the deck. but I think you've with options, like if you add an Iron Bundle in there, that can usually get you like where you need to go against Charizard.
You play Boss, you got Gift Energy too.
Yeah, if you play Boss. And Counter Catcher. I think also the Raichu with like, I feel like the Raichu plus the Reboot Pod is like what you need for just like explosive KOs, like maybe even two Raichu. If you can,
that's what I was thinking,
set up multiple in a game. Yeah,
definitely. The Raichu is very interesting, really cool idea. I think, we've seen in City Leagues a lot of Iron Bundle, a lot of people trying out some bosses and cutting down on the Counter Catcher counts. Most people are trying the Prime Catcher, but I think that that sounds really cool. That sounds like a really strong play. I think the next deck to go over then is Charizard, since we've been talking about it so much already. A lot of people are kind of targeting it as the S-tier deck of the next format. And there's two versions of Charizard that... One has basically fallen completely out of favor this format, and then it's going to flip next format, where everyone's seems to be way higher on Charizard Bibarel. And this is something that is pretty interesting, because a lot of people were really confused when the City League results first came out. And people were like, why is everyone playing Charizard Bibarel when there's no more path in format now, and your Pidgeot can just be completely unchecked? And there's a bunch of reasons for it from what I've read. Who wants to come? And this was also asked on Twitter by Austin Myers, just kind of asking what cards help in rotation for each archetype and why you would choose one or the other.
I can start. I think Bibarel, one of the like the obvious reasons is that it's harder to get Rotom or into play turn one, which you really rely on the Forest Seal Stone combo to get like Charizard Pidgey up immediately. So that's like the obvious reason. But I think one of the bigger reasons is that Charizard, like in the current format, we've got decks like Gardevoir, where they can really pressure, like they can one-shot Charizard EX pretty easily. And even stuff like Giratina, super popular, which has the Requiem and whatnot. But I feel like without those like threats that can one-hit KO Charizard as easily, like there's much fewer decks which can one-hit KO Charizard EX. It becomes stronger to play with a board without two prizers on the bench. Whereas like before having a Pidgeot, it was a liability, but your Charizard was not at almost as much of a liability as the Pidgeot. Like right. 330 HP wasn't that much better than 280 HP. Whereas now it is, because there's quite a few things that can hit 280, with like Arctina becoming a more popular deck now. The Lugia needs one less energy on the Chinchino. Even that Iron Hands, yeah, which can
terrifying
knock out the Pidgeot for three prize cards. There's like a lot of little reasons why you'd rather play a game with just the Charizard EX as the only two prizer. If the fact that you have the barrel ends up missing you a turn somewhere in the game, you can probably earn it back just by the fact that you don't have any liabilities in play.
Yeah, I kind of agree with those things. I think that's the brand new card that's been translated to Cryptomaniacs, Deciphering and something else. I don't know the other translation for it, but I know people are translating it in two different things. That card works fantastically. With a deck that, you know, is able to use something like the Prime Catcher, you can just put it on top, then you can use the barrel. Also, you know, like with things like Arvin, you can still do that. I honestly think that the Barbaro version is like still pretty close to the Pidgeot. You know, obviously not being able to VIP pass for Rotom is a problem. You know, I can't think of the amount of times where I need to use my VIP pass to get the Rotom down just to be able to function and set up the game. So now you're like now that you have the Buddy Puffin, it makes a little bit more sense, I think, to play the Barbaro. I also don't necessarily know how overpowering Charizard is. I think that a lot of things on social media, like when it comes to the deck, are hyping it up with not a ton of results to back it up. So I think that the deck is obviously very good, but I would not call it like this tier S, unbeatable deck. I think there's a lot of things in the format that can beat it. Things, with like the maximum belt now, I think it's called, right? That like being able to hit, Charizard for knockout is very good. I know like Arctina has been, playing that card now, because now you can, one shots a, Charizard, with a Giratina with that ace spec. So I don't think it's broken. I think it's a reasonably fair deck. I think it's a tier one deck, but I think that people hyping it up as this, clear like best deck in format is like, I don't think necessarily the truth. But I think that Barbaro probably just starting off, I like having multiple ways to like get into Charmeleon. I think that's nice. I think that if people decide to, throw back in things like their TM Devos in their deck and stuff like that, that hits, that hurts Pidgeot significantly more than the Barbaro version, because it's just like naturally better because you play like two or three Charmeleon. So yeah, I think they're both good, but I personally prefer the Barbaro one a little bit more as of right now.
A couple other things too, like if you've ever played Charizard Barbaro before, like when it first came out, one of the biggest issues is that you would end up with like your really unplayable hands that had a lot of like, you just couldn't draw cards, and the big part of that was you drew into your battle VIP passes in the late game. And so one of the advantages of Buddy Puffin in this deck is now you can still burn those cards out of your hand to actually draw new cards, which it doesn't seem too big, but if you played the deck before, like the biggest issue it had was drawing into just completely unplayable hands. So having four more playable cards in your deck throughout the game is definitely a positive. And also one loss for the Pidgeot version, which makes it worse, is Mew Celebrations is rotating. And that was a huge part of how the deck worked in the early game, where a lot of times it could get your battle pass for Rotom, or it could help you, get your rare candies on turn two, since your deck more rely on rare candy, stuff like that. So without that, the deck definitely becomes a little bit less consistent as well. So that's another like loss for Charizard Pidgeot.
Yeah,
and even more on the point of unplayable cards, you don't have to play as many like stadium cards anymore, because you don't have to worry about path. So those don't clog up your hand when you've already got a stadium in play.
Yeah, I something to point out too is like, you were mentioning the Pidgeot being a liability and kind of answering what cards come in post-rotation that benefit either version. We saw the Champions League list that was playing Pidgeot's Ard. Was it felt forced to play Hero Cape over Prime Catcher just to protect the Pidgeots, honestly, from being huge liabilities on the bench. And also you can throw it on other stuff too, but not being able to feeling pressure to even play that in the first place over something as powerful as Prime Catcher probably doesn't feel great, honestly. So kind of an interesting difference in ace spec there.
Yeah, I think Hero's Cape is like a sign that there's not enough decks playing Lost Vacuum.
Yeah.
That card is really, really powerful. Like on a Charizard with 430 HP is
right,
pretty
yeah.
good.
Absurd.
But if we see Lost Vacuums go into decks as I think they should, then the Hero's Cape becomes a lot less powerful.
There are some other decks that popped up that are new post rotation, namely Ancient Box. We already talked about the Future Iron Hands, and then Great Tusk Mill. Any thoughts on Ancient Box or Great Tusk Mill? We don't have to go super in depth with it, but just any kind of at a glance thoughts from what y'all seen so far.
I don't think Great Tusk is that good. Like, I think it's like okay, but like I don't know how it beats like a Lugia that gets like a Lugia into the active Ionos or something like that, and then just starts smacking. Like, I think that. It's a cool deck, you know. This deck kind of reminds me of this old deck called Houndoom Mill, way back. I think in like 2015 or 2016. It discarded like the top two cards of your deck, and you played things like Hammers and just, you know, like way too like kind of disrupt. It would sometimes do well, but it would, you know, really struggle against, you know, like decks that were able to efficiently just deal lots of damage, you know, like one shot the Houndoom. So that's just like one of the decks that. You know, I kind of think of, you know, I think that Ancient Box actually has a lot of potential. I think that this deck moving forward is quite good. I don't think it's overpowering. I think it's balanced, you know, because it does have quite a few consistency issues, I think, just because you don't have a natural like draw engine that's very stable. I was looking at the list that got top 16. I don't play Artisan. I play Pokestop. I think Pokestop makes a ton of sense in this deck. I kind of just like kind of adjusted how this deck was built and things like Pokestop just make a lot of sense because you can dump a lot of. I mean, like ancient things, which just, you know, seems good. The drum card, I don't know how good the drum card is in the deck because you just can run into situations early game where it's like, do I really want to bench all these, you know, cards to be able to use drum to draw more? And then I can't get them off the field. So you're not actually, you know, increasing your damage that much. So there were some other things like Prime Catcher that I was kind of considering in it. So, you know, I think that deck actually has potential though. I think it's probably starting the format in tier two and probably mill, probably tier 2.5.
Sure.
I think one of the important card, like one of the difficult matchups with this deck is Charizard because it's super hard to get to the 330 HP mark. So like if I were to play this deck, I'd like look into playing like even maybe like two Cobalion, the one that increases damage done to dark Pokemon.
Do they stack?
Just to fix that. Yeah, I'm pretty sure they stack.
Oh, that's really cool. I don't know that.
Yeah, although I've
two Cobalion on my list before.
But yeah, at least one Cobalion, one Cobalion does help a lot. And then two would probably make the matchup even like, slightly favorable maybe. Cause you can get there, eventually. And then yeah, just trade two AKOs for a little while. But the issue like is if, like two prizer decks have, they need to set up way less attackers and they also have options of using stuff like Collapse Stadium to heal their Charizard. So yeah, I feel like that matchup, if you're not able to one-shot the Charizard, it's pretty rough. And I also think Lugia might be a problem for this deck, just because something with 280 HP is a lot early game. And then Lugia can easily transition into one prizers for the rest of the game. So if Lugia can get an early lead, and then they also play Collapse Stadium. So yeah, you could like attack with Lugia. Ideally, it takes a hit, you collapse away, and then just play with one prizers for the rest of the game. You're going to end up favorable on that trade.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of, so I remember I actually did that pretty much. So I played at NAIC versus a United Wings deck, and I took the first two prizes with Lugia. This was actually in day two, because United Wings, you know, actually did pretty decent at that tournament. I took the first two prizes. They weren't, you know, like, able to, you know, like, reach, like, that one shot, and then I just went one prizer, one prizer, one prizer, one prizer. And I think that's the exact, like, problem, like, that like you're going to run into, especially if they, like, win the coin flip, get the turn to Lugia hit. How are you... like, how are you responding? Like, especially like if they get the turn two hit, there's just no way you're doing 280 damage back. And if you don't do 280 damage back, they're going to take a two prize lead. And at that point, they can just use their Snorlaxes and their Shinchinos, and they pretty much can like guarantee, win the game. So
I feel like if this deck had access to Echoing Horn still, it'd be a lot better than it is currently. Because I could imagine this deck like trading evenly and then going like Echoing Horn counter catcher, Echoing Horn counter catcher, and getting like a huge lead from that. But sadly, for this deck, Echoing Horn rotates.
Yeah.
Yeah. The last deck I wanted to talk about, brought on here by Brendan Streeter from Twitter. How are we feeling about Snorlax post rotation? We saw I got three of the top 16 slots at Champions League. The deck functionally is very almost unchanged with the new format from what we've seen in those lists. It's basically just throwing in Eerie and replacing the Echoing Horn slot, potentially with Mantine, sometimes not. What are your thoughts, Jake, on this? You wrote a huge article on Snorlax stall for Cut or Tap a while ago, so what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I personally think this is the best deck in the format, and it's a good sign that in best of one 25 minutes, with double game losses, if you end up in a tie scenario, that three of them still made top 16 at the Champions League. Like, it must be the best of the best control players getting lucky, or this deck is insane. And I think it's the latter, that this deck is just super powerful. And I think that once we get over to our time rules, Pidgeot, like the Pidgeot build, becomes a lot more playable, because in Japan, like, you don't have enough time to quick search. Otherwise, you're just losing the game. So you have to like just draw pass with this deck or get the Chiyu involved to take like aggressive milling. But the more teched out Pidgeot EX build, which can deal with things like Minior, and beats the Lax Mirror, I think is like very, very strong in this format. Charizard can't really do anything about it. Like, you're not going to tech. If you play Minior, it's just going to get Lost City if the Pidgeot version becomes popular. You can play the 101 Gengar, but if they play Lost City plus the Defiance Band, they can deal with that as well. And then a lot of the other decks like just don't have a way to deal with Snorlax. But yeah, there are some tough matchups for this. Like, I know Lugia is probably a bit sketchy. It's easier to stick Temple into play, but Lugia has more attackers and less liabilities. It's really the only Lumineon is the only thing they can get trapped. The Ancient Box could pose a bit of a problem because there's not much to trap in there as well. Everything can attack, and then also the Iron Hands Iron Crown deck can get pretty early leads. But at the same time, if they don't play any switch cards, which most variants haven't, then you just trap a Kobalion and you win the game.
Yeah, I think it's decent. You're good.
I was gonna say another deck that posed an issue that really I wasn't like thinking about too much, but has done pretty well is Arctina. I don't think that control can deal with that super easily. They can easily kill Rotom with like Arceus and Boss and stuff. They have four judges, which is like horrible for you. They don't have very many things that can get trapped super easily. Like, I mean, they do have a couple, but they also do have some switches. And obviously, you'd have to get it down under Judge. You'd have to get those things down. It just seems like a pretty annoying deck to face against. They also have Shred for Mimikyu. So I don't I don't think you can beat them super easily either. I mean, I'd have to test the matchup. I haven't, but I don't think that's a great matchup for control either.
Yeah, I think stall at beginning of formats can definitely take advantage of players that don't know exactly what they're doing. I think that the Lugia matchup and just like Arceus in general, like, has been kind of like, I think it's always been okay for stall, but I think if they add Giratina to the mix as well, it becomes even scarier, just due to that shred option. I do think the deck is very, very good. The problem I think will be Lugia, just because pretty much everything can attack. Them having only one Lumineon, them not playing things like Pumpkaboo anymore, Squawkabilly, there's a lot of cards that they used to have. You know, that could potentially have been, you know, labeled as liabilities. But now with almost just how slow and conservative this, you know, build of Lugia is, like this build doesn't really have to discard a lot of energies, you know, like it can kind of just sit there using Read the Wind, Serena to draw cards, Jock as well. So it's, you know, you're going to have to go through pretty much all, you know, 16 to 17 energies as well, which, you know, is definitely possible for Snorlax, but it's, you know, easier said than done. But overall, like, I feel like it can beat most things in the format. You know, things like Charizard is just like almost an auto win, it feels like. And like that matchup is just, you know, like so easy, I feel like, for Snorlax. And they, like, even if they play Meteor, it's not really that big of a deal, because you can loop Mimikyu and also Pidgeot V, you know, pretty consistently, just like over and over again. You can attach, you know, onto the Mimikyu, you know, give it more HP with the cape, and there's just really like nothing that they can do in those situations. So like, it's good, but I don't think it's like overpowered by any means. I think there's some hard matchups.
Yeah,
I feel like some kind of like hybrid approach between, because there's like quite a few matchups like Charizard where like you don't really need much to beat it at all, and then some you got a lot more room to worry about like the Arctinas and Lugias. I think there's probably something there that Sander can figure out to deal with those matchups with like 80% of your deck is focused on like that stuff, and then the 20% gets by against the like the normal trapping strategies. But I think I think for now, like, yeah, if the Arctina is popular and Lugia is popular, then we might see control get countered by those enough. But yeah, when that Blood Moon Ursaluna EX comes out in the next set, I think we'll have to revisit that side of the matchup spread.
for sure. All right, we're running out of time here, so I kind of just want to quick fire some questions that we got from Twitter. We'll try to do this for all of our podcasts going forward. I'd love to have a mailbag continuing. If we don't get to your question and you asked it, I will make sure it's added to the doc and we'll try to get to it in a future episode. First question from Thomas Patrick asking, I'll be experiencing my first rotation as a player. What should I prepare for? And how can I quickly adapt to a new meta at the first locals?
I guess I'll start. So this is like what to prepare for the new format?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the very beginning of the format, it's going to be somewhat similar to what the Japan tournaments look like. And this actually goes into one of the other questions, I believe. So I can kind of answer two at once, whether or not like UIC or like Orlando will be similar to the Champions League that we just had. I think it will be kind of similar. Like, I think that Lugia will probably be the most played or the second most played deck along with Charizard. I think that typically at the beginning of formats, people look at comfort decks that, you know, they have played before or still, you know, have, you know, cards for. So I think that those are going to be, you know, like two specific decks that see maybe 16 to 20%. I wouldn't be surprised if both of them took up a combined 35 to 40% of the format, just because people have the cards like for the most part, and they're, you know, pretty easy to learn like the ins and outs of like what you should be doing. So, you know, those would be the decks I'd definitely be like preparing for. I think Stahl won't see a whole lot of play. I think it will do well, but Stahl never sees, you know, more than probably 5%. So I would not be surprised to see it kind of around, you know, 3 to 5% of the format. But yeah, that's kind of what I have to say. Like, prepare for Lugia and prepare for Charizard for sure.
I think one of the most important things after rotation as well is just like making sure you play a consistent deck that like works a lot, because everyone's going to be trying out new things, right? Like, there's not going to be a huge, like, there's not going to be a super concentrated meta, especially at the beginning of the format. So just making sure that your deck can set up and win games is a lot of times the most important part. A lot of people will just be playing inconsistent decks that they just cooked up themselves, and a lot of times that's not the best choice in a new format.
Sure. Or modifying working decks to add their own text to fix things that don't actually need fixing, or just accidentally making the deck worse definitely makes a lot of sense, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like there's not too much difference between just a regular set release and a rotation, other than like I almost equate like a rotation to like 1.5 sets releasing, or maybe even 2 sets releasing at the same time, like the feeling of that. So just like doing the same thing that you'd normally do, like pay attention to results. And like I especially think following like what happens in online tournaments especially is like a very important thing to do, because those tend to have like online tournaments sort of experience this like deck of the week phenomenon, or deck of like the couple days where something wins an online tournament and then everybody plays it for the next couple online tournaments. And you can gather like really useful data there about like what the extremes of a format could look like, of like if this deck is like super overplayed, what else happens with it. And I think we'll see that with some of the new decks, like that the Iron Hands Maraidon like Countercatcher deck. We'll probably end up it'll be good to get results to see how that deck performs when everybody's playing the new thing, and to see how it performs in a metagame where it can be countered, or it's the best, it's the most played deck. Just having that like that data, I think, is very important for figuring out or predicting what like the actual EUIC meta is going to be.
Speaking of EUIC, next question from Maddox TCG. What approach do you take for deck building into an unknown meta such as EUIC and Orlando?
Consistency, consistency, consistency. Pretty much the thing that Hedrick said. You know, we've seen this in the past. Like last EUIC, we saw DT Mew, just like a very pure, consistent build. I believe Pablo Meza got top four with that. We saw Arceus, you know, win the tournament with Alex Shemansi, just a very consistent deck that did what it needed to do every single game. And I think that's why decks like Lugia will definitely see a lot of success. And actually, I think Arceus will do well. And like just because the deck does what it needs to do every single game, regardless of the power level of Arceus not being astronomically high, I think that there, you know, like is a lot of benefits to playing a deck saying, okay, I'm gonna sit down every tournament, and you know, and pretty much every round of the event, and I can't, like I'm pretty confident I'll be able to do at least something, which with some decks, you know, is not the case. So you know, when it comes to deck building, especially at these, you know, like massive tournaments like EUIC and Orlando, I don't expect myself to be over teching for anything. I just want to be able to play you know, Pokemon better than like the average player, and I don't want to be losing to things out of my control. So yeah,
like if you're a good player, yeah, you can sort of take advantage of the lack of preparation from everybody in the field. Like that's one of the biggest ways you can get an advantage, is if players aren't playing optimally, you'll have an advantage over them. And in a new format, it's takes longer for players to learn how to play their deck correctly. So you can, as long as you're playing a consistent deck, you're a good player, you'll have a good shot at doing well, just because of everybody else will need a longer amount of time to get to where you are.
Yeah, I think Arctina will probably actually be pretty popular, especially like it is a consistent deck. It's a straightforward deck with a lot of the same matchups, right? Like a lot of like the same game plan in every matchup.
Yeah.
So I feel like that will be a pretty popular, and that's not a terrible choice either, just to pick a straightforward deck that works and does the same thing in every matchup, because in a new format, everyone's decks aren't going to be working the best, right? Lists still aren't figured out, so I think playing a consistent deck like something like that, not necessarily Arceus, but Arceus or something similar to that, is a pretty good idea.
I feel like Arctina though is going to have a hard time against a 15% Lugia field, or even like 10% or something, because Lugia seems to kind of destroy that deck with like V-Guard putting you out of range and Shinchino being able to take one shots. So if it is like a really Lugia popular format, like I don't think the Arctina will do too well.
It is not the easiest for Lugia to set up under Judge, but I don't know. We'll see, I guess.
Yep.
It's probably not a great matchup.
Yeah, still early. Who knows what will happen? The only other thing I wanted to add to that as an answer is the advice I got from a very good player and very useful piece of advice for this tournament is that like EUIC, these post-rotation tournaments are the ones that reward the sheer amount of work you put in more than like any other tournament. So if you want to do well, the earlier you put in work, the more testing you do, this tournament will show up more so than probably any other regular tournament throughout the year. Definitely recommend just putting in the work, putting in as much time as you can. That is the advice I am following, at least. But yeah.
That's exactly right.
Yep. We don't have time for more questions, so that's going to be it for this first episode of the rebooted Dead Draw Gaming Podcast. Thank you all so much, Jake, Gabe, and Andrew. Any shout-outs you want to do? Where can people find you on Twitter? Let's start with Jake.
Yeah, you can find me Jake K. Gearhart on Twitter. Search my name, I'll pop up.
You'll just find Jake automatically if you're on TCG Twitter in a 20-comment thread. So it's all good. Andrew?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at PokeHawkeye.
Gabe?
You can follow me pretty much at everything smartTCG or smart_TCG. Shout out Dead Draw Gaming. If you're interested in coaching, hit me up on Medify. And yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you all for being here. My Twitter is EtchyOK. I also stream on Twitch at Etchy. We're going to be doing a lot more episodes of this coming soon. Right now, I think we're aiming for a cadence of every other week. So if you enjoy this, please be sure to subscribe to the YouTube channel for us. We'd really, really appreciate it. Be sure to like the video, comment. I'm also going to take feedback for these very seriously. So if you have any feedback, feel free to DM it to me directly on Twitter at EtchyOK again. Or you can just put it in the comments of the YouTube video too. Like I really want these to be as helpful for you all as entertaining as it is. So that's going to be it for this episode. Thank you all so much for watching. Take care.